Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm your host, Brendan Maslauskas-Dunn.
And I'm Mark Dunley. Today, we begin by talking with Jeff Berryhill, a worker at the New School, who was recently involved in a workplace occupation and strike.
Then we'll have a short report from the recent Families Together rally at the Federal Building in Albany about the issue of separating children from their immigrant parents. And later we'll talk with Chuck Collins about the issue of income inequality and reparations.
We'll finish up with some friends of mine, Paul and Mary Liz Stewart, who are the founders of the Underground Railroad History Project, to hear more about their work and their walking tour on Saturday in Troy. But first, let's start the show off with some rapid-fire local headlines.
The Times Union reports that Robert Sampson, New York's top technology official, made significant errors in a financial form filed a year ago. His 2016 form did not list any holdings in IBM, his former employer, and a company whose official Sampson has met with at least 9 times concerning state contracting opportunities, according to state records. Matters involving Sampson are part of a state inspector general investigation prompted by an anonymous letter sent to Governor Andrew Cuomo's office last year. Sampson's disclosure forms failed to disclose his position on the board of Fort Schuyler Management Corporation, the nonprofit development arm of SUNY Polytechnic Institute. He is currently its chairman. The former head of SUNY Polytechnic is under indictment for corruption regarding the awarding of various contracts.
President Donald Trump's former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, is going to jail. On Friday, Manafort was ordered into custody after a federal judge revoked his house arrest, citing newly filed obstruction of justice charges. He faces several felony charges, including tax evasion, bank fraud, money laundering conspiracy, and acting as an unregistered foreign agent related to his Ukrainian political work. Money he funneled through offshore accounts and loans he took out on property in the United States.
Governor Cuomo announced the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority was awarded an $18.5 million U.S. Department of Energy grant to lead a nationwide research and development consortium for the offshore wind industry. The grant will be matched by financial support from the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority and is for a term of 4 years.
The United States Supreme Court on Thursday struck down Minnesota's broad restrictions on voters wearing political hats, T-shirts, and pins to the polls, but said states can place limits on such apparel. Minnesota contended the restrictions were reasonable, kept order at polling places, and prevented voter intimidation. But the justices, in a 7-2 ruling, said the state's limits on political clothing violated the free speech clause of the First Amendment.
The Troy Record reported that the General Services Committee voted Thursday to reduce the fees dog owners must pay to get their animals back after they've been seized by the city. The change still has to be approved by the Finance Committee, then by the City Council before taking effect. Right now, there's a base fee of $350 the city charges per dog, plus $50 per day starting on the 6th day from the date of the seizure. The base fee is the same for every offense. The city also charges a $50 transport fee and a $100 fee if the dog is not licensed. The proposed change would make it a $50 fee for the first offense, $100 for a second, and $150 for a third. It would set the transport fee at $25 and the unlicensed fee at $50.
The Record reported that the Troy City Council voted 4-3 in favor of amending its nuisance ordinance to give the city 120 days to call a hearing on a particular property. In Troy, points are assigned to properties for city code and other law violations. After a certain number of points are accrued, the properties are deemed nuisances, and the mayor can issue orders against them. Presently, the city rules allow the city to call for a hearing on such property within 60 days. For those of you just tuning in, you've missed some really good stuff. But you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM.
And to learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, you can visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Next, Brendan will take us to New York City, where he spoke with Jeff Berryhill, a worker at the New School who was recently involved in a workplace occupation and strike.
This is Brendan Masoskis Dunn with WOOC, currently at the New School in New York City, at the site of a recent occupation that a bunch of workers held here at the college. And I'm sitting down with Jeff Berryhill, who is clerical staff at the New School. He's a member, rank and file member of Teamsters Local 1205, and he was a participant and supporter of the recent New School occupation. So thanks for joining us on WOOC, Jeff.
Thanks for having me.
Give us some background. You know, I'm sure most of our listeners haven't even heard about the New School occupation. Start by telling us what you do here at the New School and how this all started.
I've worked here for 2 years now. I'm a graduate. I completed a history degree here, a master's program. While I was in the master's program, I worked in the office of the executive dean at one of the colleges. I currently work there now, just doing clerical support, so schedule meetings, file papers, etc. Pretty much the origin of the occupation began when the treasurer of the university, and he's also a vice president, announced that they were going to discontinue using an external partner for food services at the university in the cafeteria. And in the process of discontinuing the food service with this external vendor, they were going to lay off all 31 cafeteria workers in the process. They explained in their communication that these workers would then, who were union members, they're members of Unite, I can't remember what number it is. They were told that they could apply for the jobs, but they could not be guaranteed to get their jobs back. Also in this communication, they talked about, the New School likes to pride itself on this like progressive tradition and ideals and such. And so part of it was part of their explanation for discontinuing this partnership was to bring in more like locally sourced and organic type foods options and to involve students in food service and food prep and food acquisition. Long story short, 31 workers with pensions, union benefits, and such were going to lose their jobs with no guarantee that they would be able to have jobs once the food service was brought internal. A group on campus called the Communist Student Group caught wind of this and began cultivating relationships with many of the cafeteria workers. They did painstaking work developing the trust and commitment of these workers. They came forth with a plan saying, hey, a group of students and our supporters wanna lay claim to the cafeteria. We wanna make a series of demands, including the preservation of your jobs. The workers were thrilled by this gesture. They were dissatisfied with their union leaderships and their willingness not to do anything necessary to preserve their jobs, and were, you know, part of this process. I first met the students who were going to put out the call for the occupation at an event that I was helping to host and organize in my staff capacity here at the New School. They had a cafeteria worker come in and explain what was happening to them, how losing their benefits was going to imperil the health and well-being of their family, how like losing their job, losing this job specifically was going to be especially devastating because they appreciated the relationships they had with students and they found great dignity in the work they did here. They spoke at this event, they leafleted in front of it, and they invited people to come to an organizing meeting that night. And this was done April 27th. The occupation kicked off on May 1st, May Day. There was a rally of sorts on campus. Folks laid claim, took the space in the cafeteria. I mean, another interesting thing, so the Communist Student Group, who They are sort of like the student wing of a group in Brooklyn, based in Brooklyn, called the Maoist Communist Organization. They had been meeting for years. They had a different name in advance. I think it was called the Revolutionary Student Council or something of sorts. But anyway, they had been meeting on campus every Friday for the last 2 years, reading historical text, devising plans, strategizing and such. So like they had built sort of a small nucleus that, and like this was sort of, that was ready to activate, and this was sort of their coming out party. They kicked off the occupation, but had pretty limited goals aside from kicking off the occupation. Once the occupation was in gear, a number of folks with sort of a syndicalist orientation who had kind of been involved in grassroots or like rank and file kind of labor organizing were like, hey, there are processes necessary in order to sustain an occupation. So they came forth, introduced the idea of having general assemblies, helped make plans and preparations for like, what are we going to need to stay the night? What are we going to need to provide food? What are we going, you know, just what are we going to do to implement a media strategy and publicity campaign? So folks took that in earnest and sort of were able to complement and supplement the, where the CSG, the Communist Student Group, had kind of had failed to recognize the importance of. After the first couple days, workers were in and around the occupation the first few days. Some of them stayed the night, but at the behest of their union leadership, they were encouraged not to participate. The union leadership talked about, legal problems they would encounter by participating in the occupation. The union leadership was also then in negotiations with the university about preserving the jobs of the workers and such. Partway through the occupation, worker participation no longer continued. Nonetheless, 4 days before the occupation ended, workers came out, 15 to 17 workers, I can't remember specifically, came and visited the occupation after signing a joint agreement with the university promising to preserve their jobs. So long story short, the action taken on May 1st that lasts until May, 14th or 16th, I can't remember the specific days, kept the job of the workers. Now, although the workers weren't intimately involved in the day-to-day of the occupation, they came 4 days before the occupation closed after signing their agreement and visited the occupation with family members, kids, and such. And each of them took the megaphone, addressed the crowd, and said such things as, like, no one's ever fought for me as hard as you guys fought for me. Talked about how instrumental, like, preserving their job was to them. And expressed that they learned a valuable lesson that they wield power. So, like, one of the things is they understood that, like, it was, like, for them, sort of a first moment of understanding, like, the power of collective struggle and militancy. The occupation ended at the behest of those who were occupying. They've had a few subsequent meetings in the meantime in the hopes to identify ways in which to build on the momentum and build on the power and organizational know-how that was developed in the context of the occupation. And I think it's worth noting, too, those who participated in the day-to-day occupation, who helped do the food service, food prep, media stuff, were often folks who hadn't been involved in politics before. One of the people I talked to was in between jobs, and she was like, I needed something to eat. I was moved by this and given an opportunity to put these skills into action. Another young person who said she was simply like trying to find community in this space, because the interesting thing about the new school is it's an urban-based campus, so there's less of sort of the conventional campus community taking root. And so like they were able to find community in a way that they hadn't in the past. Lastly, I just want to notice that a significant portion, if not a majority, of the participants were queer women, which, you know, gave it a different character, and I don't think was always appreciated, too, you know, by people who were observing it from the outside. But largely it was queer women who, you know, gave the occupation sort of its life, its energy, and I think that's worth noting and emphasizing.
So it sounds like it was a major victory and also led in large part and had, you know, high activity from queer women and women of color.
Mm-hmm. And it was an extraordinary victory. It was one of those rare instances, you know, where worker-student struggle, in this particular instance, was able to deliver demands that conventional roots, conventional politics, conventional labor politics weren't able to deliver.
All right, well, that's all the time we have. Thanks for joining us on WOC, Jeff.
And that was our own Brendan Dunn interviewing Jeff Berryhill, who he met this past weekend at the site of a workplace occupation at the New School.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM. Our next segment will cover the Families Belong Together rally that was just held.
On June 14, 2018, this week, Citizen Action of New York, the New York Civil Liberties Union, and others joined activists in cities across the United States in hosting a Families Belong Together rally to protest the current administration's treatment of migrants and asylum seekers, particularly separating the children from the parents. WOOC correspondent Elizabeth Press was at the rally in Albany. Here are some of the voices from the event.
No hate, no fear. Everyone is welcome.
My name is Jamaica Miles. I'm the lead organizer for Citizen Action of New York here in the Capital District. Citizen Action is a grassroots organization that fights for social, racial, economic, and environmental justice. We are one of the co-sponsors of today's event that's happening here in Albany and also happening in Glens Falls. And these events are happening all across the country to raise awareness and to stand up and speak out against families that are being ripped apart by the federal administration and making sure that representatives that currently hold seats understand that we will not stand for it, that we demand that families stay together, that families belong together, that we are going to fight not just with our words, but also with our vote. Come election season, that we need to create systemic and institutional changes to ensure that any individual that is a resident inside this country or across the world is receiving the same human dignity and respect that we expect for the U.S. citizens.
My name is Jennifer, and I'm here to support the children and the family, because I don't believe children should be separated, never under no circumstances, from their parents. And I believe that there shouldn't be no wall, no borders, and we got to come together as a community to make a change, because the strong administration is corrupted. It's a disgrace to this country. I came to this country in 1990. My mother brought me here legally, and I'm a citizen, and I do vote. But I feel like you vote and no changes is made. They make a lot of promise of change, but nothing happens. My civil rights have been violated many a times. My human rights have been violated many a times. And my constitutional rights has been violated many a times. And I'm here today to let the whole world know there's no more fear. I'm gonna fight all the way for my family and for all the families as well.
My name is Ceci Alfonso, and I'm an activist, I've always been. And I'm here because it's inhumane, it's cruel, and it's un-American to treat people who are seeking sanctuary, protection, and being discriminated against. And I must note that those who come to this country and are not legal and happen to be European and white are not being treated like brown and black people are. It's cruel. It's indecent, it's inhumane to separate a child and children from their parents. And if we are a country that's compassionate and caring, it makes no sense. It's a contradiction, it's against our core values of decency and concern for our fellow human being. And as a human being, I am proud to say that I stand here for humanity and compassion and not exclusion and discrimination.
I'm Cyrus, I'm 8, and I think that children being ripped away from their family is really wrong.
How would that make you feel if that was in your situation?
I would feel really, really sad and upset.
My name is Ray Muniz. In 1967, my dad came here from Cuba, and he came here without documentation. And he was really lucky to come to an America that had a policy that was accepting, that didn't discriminate based upon his skin color or his name or his funny accent, but an America that believed that he could become better. And that's why I'm here today, because that America is under siege, and that's the American promise that I want to fight for everybody. I know hundreds of people in this country who are scared every day, driving to and from work. I can't imagine the sort of fear that envelops somebody who might be here without documentation if they get pulled over on their way to work to try to make an honest day's wage. And I think that I have an obligation as somebody who is a direct result of unfettered immigration to fight for these folks who are just facing these disastrous, terrible, despicable policies at the border.
Those were some voices recorded by WOOC correspondent Elizabeth Press at the Families Belong Together rally in Albany. For more information, please visit familiesbelong.org. For those just tuning in, I'm Mark Dunley.
And I'm Brendan Maslauskas-Dunn. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM in Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. Chuck Collins is the founder of the Institute for Policy Studies, an expert on wealth inequality, and an advocate for race-based reparations in America. The author of Born on Third Base and Is Inequality in America Irreversible was a keynote speaker at the 2018 Slow Living Summit, where he sat down with correspondent Mark Russo to share his views.
Hi, this is Mark Russo, joined by Chuck Collins. Chuck, thank you for joining us.
Thanks. Good to be with you, Mark.
So tell me a little bit about your background and how you began to explore income inequality and the world of alternative finance.
Well, I think I was affected as a young person growing up in the Detroit area and just in a city where there was enormous polarization between city and suburb, rich and poor, white and black, and I think that really had an effect on me. But, you know, I think what happened really is starting in the late 70s and 80s, you know, we started to become a much more unequal society. Both wages started to sort of flatten out, and more income and wealth was flowing to the very, very top. And I could kind of see that in all kinds of ways, particularly working at the community level on affordable housing. I could just see how that was affecting people. But I also grew up, you know, I was born on third base. I grew up in a wealthy, affluent family in suburban Detroit. So I sort of had the perspective, the other side of the story, which is seeing how wealth was multiplying, wealth was growing. How I would describe it is how advantage was accelerating for people at the top and how disadvantage was kind of, and barriers were growing for everyone else. So that really got me interested, and I helped start a group called United for a Fair Economy to do kind of advocacy about inequality. And then for the last a dozen years, I've been working at the Institute for Policy Studies. And I co-edit a website called inequality.org, which for your listeners would be a good resource to learn more about both the picture as well as what people are doing to reverse inequality.
What role can capital play in remediating the damage to our psychological environment, our living environment, and our built environment that was largely caused by our capitalist economy?
Well, I think, you know, this conference is focused a lot on investment, but I would argue that probably the most important thing we could do is actually tax high concentrations of wealth, high incomes, and invest in public goods like public infrastructure, access to higher education, access to training and skills, subsidized affordable housing, you know. So I think there's a way in which investors or investment capital can support certain kinds of enterprises. And in this case, we're looking at here at this conference, looking at the, you know, how do we build a regional food system? But to be honest, I'm not sure we're going to fundamentally reverse inequality through for-profit investing. There has to be some fundamental redistribution of wealth and power. I guess I would say there's somewhat of a limitation. You know, if we're trying to deploy capital, maybe it should be without strings, without debt. You know, how did a white middle class get built in this country after World War II? Through debt-free higher education and 1% fixed rate 30-year loans and for purchasing houses and farms. I mean, we taxed wealth at higher levels and invested it in a way that expanded wealth and opportunity for a lot of people. So that seems like a good formula to me.
You're one of the few folks that I know of who is exploring the idea of reparations on a broad scale in the United States and how the economics of a historical justice program might work or look. Can you explore that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a kind of complicated discussion, but the way I would look at it is, you know, we have this racial wealth divide now. The median white wealth is 35 times black wealth, you know, 25 times Latino wealth. And that is not the result of differences in effort, or it's a result of the historic legacy of racism in wealth building. And it's kind of where the past shows up in the present. So people say, well, slavery was a long time ago, or, you know, Jim Crow laws don't exist anymore. But those practices really did limit and in some cases destroyed black-owned wealth, talking about particularly people of African heritage. So, you know, there's precedents around the world for reparations after World War II. After the collapse of Nazi Germany, there was a global reparations for people who, descendants of people who survived the Holocaust, and that included both cash and educational benefits, and it included investing in education institutions and so that people could learn about that history. Similarly, after World War II and the internment of Japanese Americans who were literally stripped of their properties, put in concentration camps during World War II, the United States admitted that that was wrong and actually gave cash benefits to the descendants. Ronald Reagan signed that into law. We haven't really grappled. We're sort of still in a state of arrested development in grappling with the legacy of racism, particularly for people of African descent. And I think we could do similar, both invest in cultural institutions, educational programs. Every high school graduate in this country sort of understands, really fundamentally understands the role of slavery, of the Black Holocaust, if you will, the impact of Jim Crow's separate and unequal, just our history. That should be part of it, as well as why wouldn't we do the same things that I just talked about that help build a white middle class? Why wouldn't we have a first-time homebuyer program, you know, 1% 35-year loans, zero interest, you know, 1% interest rate that enable people to buy houses, or free, debt-free higher education? That could be part of a reparations program. So, you know, I think for several decades, there's been a proposal, H.R. 40, to have a study commission at the federal level just to look at this. But we should create kind of a people's reparations commission, just, you know, led by people of African heritage, exploring what the debt looks like. You know, how does that show up today? And what is our societal responsibility? And sometimes you hear people say, well, you know, look, I'm Irish. My relatives didn't even show up here till 50 years after slavery or whatever. Well, the fact is, if you're white in the culture, you actually still have benefited from sort of the historic compounding advantages accruing to white Americans. So it's really worth it. It's in all of our interest to really grapple with that so that we can understand how the past affects the present and then, you know, overcome that together, move forward together by repairing both reparations and repair. That's the spirit that we should enter into it.
It's comforting in a way to think of when these social problems that are so big, to think that they can be broken down and really addressed at a very basic level, things that you would just expect your own family or other, you would want other people to have, that might create more avenues towards accomplishing this on a political level than the way that the discourse currently operates around these issues of race and of property ownership and things like that. Yeah. So what you've outlined a number of them already, but what would you say are some of the most effective strategies for addressing income inequality and bringing wealth home, as you say?
Yeah. Well, if we want to look at societies today that have less inequality, we don't have to go too far. We can, you know, look at Canada that has three times the social mobility now of the United States. We can look at the Nordic countries. And one thing they have in common is they have a very high floor, meaning that there's sort of a social safety net, access to health insurance, access to basic income. If you lose your job, you are able to get lifelong job retraining. If you have a child, you get maternal and parental leave. So there's a sort of a floor, a higher floor. But those societies also invest in public goods like higher education, job training, access to childcare, things that actually sort of help create a level playing field. And then the most controversial but most important missing piece of the discussion is we need to look at things that reduce the concentration of wealth and power at the top. We need to have campaign finance reform that limits the impact of big money. We need to have a progressive tax system that taxes high income and wealth, invests it in public goods. And that's what good societies do, is they recycle opportunity. If you have $20 million, you should pay a higher percentage of your wealth and income in taxes, and that should be invested in a way that helps the next generation have the same opportunities. So, you know, we can reverse inequality. We can learn from other countries. We can look at the U.S. experience after World War II, when we taxed wealth and high incomes and invested in public goods that helped build a white middle class. We don't want to have discrimination this time around, but the lessons are there for us to draw from. So it's a political problem. It's not an economic issue. It's not like these inequalities are caused by the weather. It's a political problem. And the good news is people really want to live in a much more equitable society. The undercurrent of the population right now really wants to fundamentally shift away from this march toward plutocracy that we're living through. And polls show 70-80% of the population would like to raise a minimum wage, have a greater sort of level of health security. They believe the wealthy should pay their fair share of taxes. So there's a widespread support, but our political system at the national level has really been captured by the billionaires, and that's why we're kind of stuck in this moment. But meanwhile, the pressure is going to keep building for fundamental change.
We can only hope. Actually, we can do a lot more than hope.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is in our hands. You know, things could go badly. We could continue to pull apart. But I actually think in the next 2 years, you know, remember how the Occupy movement sort of burst on the scene and people didn't really like, whoa, where did that come from? I think we're ready for young people to lead a movement around eliminating student debt. I think we're looking at, there's all kinds of pressure to deal with the fact that we're living on yesterday's infrastructure, and that we need to address the historic legacy of racism and through some form of reparations. Those are all things that I think we're going to start to see kind of burst even more on the public scene. And those social movements are going to push us to reduce these extreme inequalities.
I'm looking forward to it.
Well, you're going to be part of it. And thanks for having the conversation. And again, if people want to learn more, check out inequality.org as kind of a portal for information and data and inspiring examples of what people are doing to reverse inequality.
Thanks, Chuck.
Thanks, Mark.
That was correspondent Mark Russo with author Chuck Collins. To learn more about Chuck's work on income inequality, visit inequality.org. On Saturday, June 16th, there will be a walking tour in Troy, which highlights sites associated with the African-American community in the first half of the 19th century. The event is called Abolition and Escape, the Underground Railroad. It is hosted by the Rensselaer Historical Society.
I'm Paul Stewart. I'm one of the co-founders of the Underground Railroad History Project, and we're here in the Stephen and Harriet Myers residence.
I'm Mary Liz Stewart, co-founder with Paul Stewart of Underground Railroad History Project, an organization that grew out of a personal research project and has taken us on quite a journey, sitting in the Stephen and Harriet Myers residence, a building that was identified as a historic Underground Railroad site in 2003.
So can you talk a bit about this, how you ended up starting the project? You refer to a personal interest.
Back in the late 1990s, I was teaching in a fifth grade classroom, and I had some 10-year-old tangible thinkers who were quite convinced that Underground Railroad history had to do only with above-ground trains or subways. And in an effort to help these tangible thinkers get beyond that understanding, I decided to invite those students who were interested to join me in researching the community's history related to Underground Railroad activity after the school day had ended. And so throughout the school year, we conducted this investigation and found some very interesting things. But as you'll, you know, as is standard form, school years come to an end, and the students who were working with me moved on to sixth grade. And so I really wanted to keep the research going, but found that it made more sense to relocate that research to the city of Albany.
And I had been working for community service agencies in Albany, but on the side I was writing for community newspapers, and I had done some articles on Underground Railroad related individuals. So after Mary Liz kind of brought that project home, we thought we'd sit in the living room and read books about this sort of thing. The things that I think were of most interest to us were almost never covered in the material that we encountered. That is, things such as, who were the people who lived here in Albany, Schenectady, Troy, who were involved in the Underground Railroad, who were the people who came here on the Underground Railroad, and did they stay or go, and what kind of stories were connected with the people that were involved. Most of the time, these other sources that we were reading seemed quite satisfied to tell stories about Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass, but had no interest at all in really getting any deeper into the material in the ways that would have been of interest to us. So we decided to make it a project for ourselves, and we started. One of the interesting features of our journey of exploration was that a lot of times people would tell us things, and then we would discover things that contradicted what they told us. So that sort of spurred us on. You know, people would say, well, you can't find any information, and we would find things. A commission was announced that it would be formed here in Albany called a Freedom Trail Commission. And there are Freedom Trail Commissions in other places around the state where local governments would designate some people to explore the story of the Underground Railroad in their particular community or region. So there are several counties that have these. At that point, we had been exploring the story for a little while and kind of had identified a number of local stories that we thought were pretty interesting and that really should be the core of what anybody was talking about in terms of the Underground Railroad story in our area. And our expectation was that this commission probably wouldn't deal with the material that we were discovering. So we looked at how can we make this unavoidable so that people will have to deal with it. What we did initially was we created what we call a walking tour. And so we did some walking tours in Albany. We did some walking tours in Troy. And we would tell those stories about those people. So for instance, in downtown Albany, we walked down to Steuben and Broadway, where the Delavan House Hotel at one time stood. Edwin C. Delavan was an abolitionist. He lived in Ballston Spa, but he also lived in Albany. He had a hotel in Albany. He was a very well-to-do man, but he was assisting the others who were involved in the Underground Railroad. Stephen Myers, who was an African-American activist, at one time worked for an organization that Delavan sponsored, the Delavan Temperance Union. He had made his fortune as a wine seller, but then he became a temperance advocate. Temperance was kind of the way that a lot of people, there was pretty widespread recognition that alcohol, you know, it's like the water was not that good, so people would drink alcohol, but alcohol was like really kind of destroying people's lives when they would go overboard with it. And so temperance was regarded as the way to respond to that, to clean up your act, to make you a better person. So Delavan at Steuben and Broadway, that's one place that had some importance. At the Steuben and Pearl, Lydia and Abigail Mott at one time had a boarding house. And Lydia and Abigail Mott were a couple of women who were Quakers who were very industrious and kind of ran counter to much of the way 19th century women were expected to behave. And they were very much involved in the Underground Railroad. At the late 1840s, they had a men's furnishing store on Broadway. They would always have clothing ready to be made available to people who were traveling through town, people who were freedom seekers. And they were also involved in actually assisting freedom seekers who were concerned about being captured through the fugitive slave laws and helping them to get transportation to move on to freedom. So and there were other people like Stephen and Harriet Myers, an African American couple who really put a lot on the line in terms of their family, household, etc. From the early 1930s on until the Civil War, they were key people in this region in terms of assisting freedom seekers, people who had escaped from enslavement and were making their way to freedom. While we were working on the walking tours, one of our friends shared with us a flyer about the Vigilance Committee of the Underground Railroad. It said, and the flyer actually had an address on it. And since we were somewhat in the business of looking for where people worked or lived or conducted their activities, we had to go find that place. And we found it, and that's what led us here to this what ultimately was named the Stephen and Harriet Myers residence.
So can you kind of describe the power that is there in seeking out these stories, stories that have been lost or deliberately hidden, like, you know, or not sought after, or like what resonates there in the present from finding those?
For me, the strength of the stories comes from bringing forward the voices of people who have been silenced, who have, in my opinion, a right to be heard. And these voices for us in the Capital Region are in large part voices of African Americans who were dedicated throughout their lifetime to working for civil rights issues, many of which are still present with us today. The writing out of these people and their voices and their stories from history is the primary attraction for me and keeps drawing me in to continue the investigation. But at the same time, sharing of these stories and these coming from the voices of people who've been written out of history seems to be rather transformational for people who come particularly to the Stephen and Harriet Myers residence. But then also as we take this, we being Paul and I, as we take these stories out to the public, we have a little saying, you know, have equipment, we'll travel. So someone calls and says, can you come provide a presentation? We're on the road to do that. So for people coming to the Stephen and Harriet Myers residence and engaging with the voices of people who've been written out of history at the residence, and then also for those who in other public settings are provided an opportunity to engage with the voices of these folks, really does seem to be very transformative. And their retelling of their experiences is quite different than the standard canon related to Underground Railroad history, which, if we really take a look at it, really focuses primarily on two individuals, both of whom are Black, both of whom I tend to characterize as being made into superheroes. So for those of us who are local folks, superhero behaviors are not exactly what we can claim to be able to do as well as they did. And so what happens with the standard canon is that it becomes easily dismissible. Two individuals, two Black individuals, they're the only ones who really had any significant part in this history. So therefore, it's a little blip on the stage of American history. And our claim, our contemporary claim is that by bringing forward the voices of many other activists in the Underground Railroad, it becomes an Underground Railroad movement, a movement of civil disobedience, a movement that is not only part of American history, but really part of an international story. And so the relationship of Underground Railroad activism has had a much bigger part to play in developments.
For me, there's very much a process of discovery and surprise as we continue to delve into the story. And this has been something we've been working on for 20 years. It was 1998 when Mary Liz was engaged with her class around this project. It's 20 years of discovery, you know, and discovery in so many different ways. We certainly assembled a certain amount of information about the individuals that were, you know, that often make up the central themes: African American Dr. Thomas Elkins, African American activist Stephen and Harriet Myers, African American youth and then writer and activist William Henry Johnson. You know, these people, their stories have become richer and richer as we've continued to dwell with and work with this story. Thomas Elkins, as an example, we knew a certain amount about him, which was far more than what others were telling about him. Some people had seen the fact that he had a couple of patents that are on registered with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. And they often march that out when in Black History Month, people, you know, kids would be doing papers and they'd say, oh, Thomas Elkins, he wrote these two, he did these two things that he got and patented. But he was also an activist on the Underground Railroad. And it was our research really that brought that to public attention.
Something that I'd like to add to what Paul has said as well is that sort of a philosophical aspect to what we've done from the beginning is to engage in strategies that invite other people to participate with us, so that this is not our story, but rather this is a community story and rightfully belongs to the community.
What was it like? Could you paint a picture for us of what it was like to be an activist in the Underground Railroad at this time, like day to day?
Here in this space where we're doing the interview, which is the Stephen and Harriet Myers residence in Arbor Hill in Albany, there are kind of two dimensions to what it might have been like. One dimension is the fact that there are lots of things that Stephen and Harriet and their four children would have to do every day that have to do with leading an ordinary life. And then from time to time, there would be people at the front door who would be in transit, freedom seekers, people who were fleeing enslavement and who had been perhaps sent by Judge William Jay in Westchester County, or perhaps by Sidney Howard Gay, the editor of the National Anti-Slavery Standard in New York City, or one of the other, two or three groups in New York City that were also seeing fugitives from slavery. You know, they would want to provide a room for them, or they would want to arrange for a room for them in the neighborhood. So that there's both an extraordinariness and an ordinariness about what they had to engage in. There was the fugitive slave laws, which meant that anyone that had escaped from enslavement might be arrested and sent back. They would be brought before a U.S. commissioner. The commissioner would act as judge and jury. The person was not allowed to speak in their own name, so
I think it's worthwhile to add as well that both women and men who would culturally would be functioning in segregated groups, you know, men in one group, women in another. They were both groups, based on gender, were active in terms of other civil rights issues. So Stephen and Harriet Myers, for instance, they weren't sitting around, you know, twiddling their thumbs waiting for the freedom seekers to show up at the door, but rather they were both engaged with groups of people who were like-minded, and so they would be working on various fundraising tasks, addressing or identifying and implementing strategies for addressing other civil rights issues, such as segregation in schools, voting rights, discrimination in housing and jobs, things of that sort. So it was a very multi-focused sense of for people in their daily lives.
Yeah.
Is it correct that at least Stephen Myers was involved with the Vigilance Committee?
Yeah, the Vigilance Committee was a group of people that came together, often compared to the Committees of Correspondence of the American Revolution. The focus for them was anti-slavery work, and so they would be both vigilant to guard the freedom of those who might be captured under the Fugitive Slave Law, vigilant to watch for freedom seekers, to enable them to move on to freedom, and also watching out for slave catchers to make sure that they could prevent them from obtaining their objectives. The Vigilance Committee was the group that really provided some support and accountability for the work that was going on, led by Stephen Myers and others who were active in helping freedom seekers. So the Vigilance Committee was, if there was a structure to the Underground Railroad, the Vigilance Committee would be a key part of that.
And it reminds me of the discord that also existed. Again, the traditional retelling of this history usually suggests right. that everybody's in the same place, everybody's in agreement, you know, the same goals are agreed to and worked on, and the reality was far different from that. We have certainly vigilance committees as one, essentially one strategy that certain individuals thought was a way to respond to the needs of freedom seekers and work at abolishing the institution of slavery. But there were also individuals who were quite dedicated to working through the political system, the result being the Liberty Party, Free Soil Party, Republican Party as strategies for abolishing the institution of slavery. Others believed that taking up arms was really the best and most appropriate response. And John Brown is the most well-known of the individuals who chose that strategy, but prior to him, we end up with Denmark Vesey, Gabriel Prosser, and others who were quite committed to this kind of assertive response to this institution. You have some people who believed that educating the public was the most important strategy because there was a lot of apologetic effort on the part of pro-slavery forces to convince the masses and, you know, others and, you know, everybody how important this institution of slavery really was and how essential it was. And so the education through newspapers, through magazines, through plays, other formats or venues, you know, became for some, lectures was another strategy as well that became very important to some individuals as a way to counter the pro-slavery posturing that was in existence. So there was also a whole collection of secular music that we have since called an abolition music as a genre, but it was a collection of music that was utilized by musicians of the period that would use melodies with which people were familiar, but the words would be changed. And these became, again, educational tools, rallying cries, and so on. So, for instance, a song like My Country, Tis of Thee becomes My Country, Tis of Thee, Dark Land of Slavery, For Thee I Weep, and goes on from there. So there's a number of songs of that type, too, that were also part and parcel.
I mean, I think I know the answer, but do you see what you do as activism?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's in a way, I mean, it's an unusual kind of activism, unusual in the sense that although there are lots of other people doing other things, there are some things that we also need on the horizon. We need cultural institutions that are really wrestling with some of the core issues that have been dogging American society from the earliest times. And so in a setting like this, we can talk about race relations in a way that that many other museums might tend to shy away from. We can also talk about some of the political oppressions that are present in our society in a way that might be a bigger a stretch for some other museum institutions.
Just being part and parcel of a community, we're not this historically yeah. focused organization plunking ourselves in the middle of a community. Obviously, this is a very residential community and a residential immediate neighborhood in which the Myers residence is located. And so for us, we have, again, foundational principle for us as an organization is to make decisions that address needs that the organization has, that and I try to address them in a way that benefits the organization and the building and properties, but do that also in a way that is then in turn also of benefit to our neighbors. So we're not thinking about us, but we are within, you know, we are members of a community, and so we need to make decisions based upon how benefits to the community at large. From the research we've done, knowing that particularly Black abolitionists saw the need to not only address the issues of abolishing the institution of slavery and assisting freedom seekers, but also dealing with responding to constructively to other civil rights issues, housing, healthcare, jobs, etc. We see what we do organizationally in terms of trying to provide employment opportunities and so on as being related to the historic actions of these activists. So.
And also it's about developing a sustainable community institution that that reflects a history that relates to African Americans and others in the community. And there needs to be important history for African Americans as well, and that history is there. It just needs to be recognized. And in this case, we came upon the building at a time when the building was really in substantial disrepair, and we're able to give that building, because of its history and its story, a different narrative.
That was Paul and Mary Liz Stewart talking about the Underground Railroad History Project in Albany. To find out more about the event, Abolition and Escape, the Underground Railroad, you can visit their website for the Rensselaer Historical Society.
That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed the episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Brendan Maslauskas-Dunn.
And I'm Mark Dunley. We want to thank Jonah Moberg for being our engineer this evening. Remember to tune back in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine portal and Facebook page.
As a reminder, WOOC 105.3 FM is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org. That's info@mediasanctuary.org. Or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.